Karen told me about a segment she heard on NPR. I think I'm getting a little bronchitis, which was fascinating to me. I didn't hear it. I heard it secondhand, describing the incidences of assault and harassment that have become public knowledge of late, and beginning to understand why men are reticent to take credit, so to speak, as being perpetrators. It said, and I think this must be very true in our Me Too moment, that women have clear recollections of every time they were harassed. They remember the clothes they were wearing, they remember the exact time of day, where they were in the room, what his breath smelled like, to the last detail, whether they threw away or burned the clothes afterward. And to men, with some exceptions, it was a non-event. And so I know, at least one other person, I myself think about it, trying to search back in our histories. Did I make a joke at work that drove someone away, that made someone uncomfortable? Did I put my hand somewhere that I thought was appropriate or that I didn't even consider but was too intimate? Was there a date I went on that seemed to be going well to me but was very uncomfortable for the other person? These are all real possibilities for every man now. And as I've said before, and this is a bit where I'm going, so I don't want to spoil the end of the sermon for you, the concept of people like Paul Ryan, I've heard say, well, I have daughters, I have a wife and a mother, I respect women, is less pertinent than saying, I have sons, I am a man, I have a father, I would like our behavior to be better in the future. I would like my sons and all my children to grow up in a world where these are not constant threats. I know that for me with my 5 boys. I would like them to be better men than I was, as I try to be a better man than my father was. That we live in new cultures, in new times, and we strive to be better and more cognizant of the value of all genders in workplace, in society, and that no one deserves to be threatened by hierarchies and power. So that's what it comes down to in a lot of ways. Even if it's not in a workplace, a man outweighs most women by a good 50%, which can lead to dates feeling very threatening. I'm not going to claim at any point that I understand the experience of a woman in America or anywhere, or that I have been saintly, but I just want to put all that out. And this is a great parasha for that, because we have 2 examples at least of sexual indiscretion. Madame Potiphar, like so many women in our scripture, who is only named for her husband, claims sexual indiscretion with Joseph as an accusation, and she keeps the garment that she pulls from him, which I think might be the exception that proves the rule, that occasionally there are accusations that are false, but they are by far the exception. And then we have the more beautiful conclusion to the story of Tamar and Judah, where Judah's response, somewhat like Louis C.K., Al Franken, although Al Franken's final speech to the Senate was not so contrite. Judah ends his speech with, "She is more right than I." It's not the same. It wasn't a case of sexual harassment. It was a case of unfulfilled familial duty. But all of it is in a similar basket of men's power over women and the danger that can pose both to women's safety and mental welfare, but also to a healthy society, even a productive economy. These are actually statistical facts. That having unequal perspectives in work actually reduces the overall economic growth, if for nothing else. There are legitimate practical and pragmatic reasons to strive against inequity, harassment, predation. We have been, as a society, and I think this is what I mean when I say I want my sons to live in a better world and be better men than I, been part of the conspiracy of silence, all of us. All of us have not supported our fellow. All of us have not stood up against predatory men. All of us have not stood up for our sisters in the workplace and elsewhere. All of us have not been aware of how a date can be experienced very differently by two people, even a same-sex couple. And that conspiracy of silence, whether it's really about gender and sexual issues or even about economic malfeasance, even about extortion and bribery, white-collar crimes of other natures, is something we live with. That is our moral failing, more often than not. So Rashi notes a midrash that Jacob mourns Joseph. So we're asked, you know, did no one tell him, not even God? I mean, Jacob has a relationship with God, as we saw last week, through angels and intermediaries. Why didn't God say anything? And the midrash says, when the brothers sold Joseph, they made a vow that none of them would tell their father, and God was included in the vow. Talk about the powers that be embracing the status quo, embracing the open secret, as the New York Times called it. That's an article I'm going to get to in a minute. And we're in the reckoning. Thank God we're in the reckoning. The beginning. I mean, the question is, will this all blow over when Roy Moore wins the Senate in Alabama? Will we start conveniently to forget? It's betting odds are. We start to forget. Will it not change culture? I mean, that's the biggest fear, is that this will be a three-month event with a lot of openness and transparency, and then we'll just go back to the way things are. I'm a betting man that will not be the case, but it is a risk. So this is the opening of the eyes. Tamar, in the story of Judah, sits famously bepetach einayim. Petach is the opening, and einayim is eyes. But it's a literal meaning. It's the crossroads of the place that would enter the town called Einayim. But of course, our sages aren't content to leave it there. They talk about it as the eye-opening place. She's about to awaken Judah to his transgression. She's about to awaken him to the fact that he did not fulfill his vows to support her after his sons had died, to remarry her appropriately. Eye-opening is probably where we are. And the question of what to do next is only just germinating. We have another beautiful image in Scripture that is expounded by Midrash. So Joseph goes out looking after his brothers. Where did they go? Out into the fields, out into the wilderness, where they would ensnare and entrap him. But he wanders off looking for them, and he meets a man. You may easily not notice this verse as you read through Torah. He meets someone and asks for directions. Our sage is never content to let strangers be strangers and anonymity remain. Say, in various places, this was one of three angels, or it was at least the angel Gabriel. That the person he met was the one who would set him on his way to the ultimate redemption of the Jewish people from Egypt. That's the sequence of events that our sages play out in Joseph's story. That Joseph went down to Egypt such that we might be redeemed. That's more or less part of the Haggadah. So he meets Gabriel on the road, and why is Gabriel there? So the best explanation comes some 16 centuries later by Menachem Mendel of Kotsk, one of the early Hasidic rabbis, one of the greats. And the angel teaches Joseph, says Menachem Mendel, always when you're lost in life's ways, at the moment when your soul is confused, you turn to yourself, you address yourself, you clarify what you seek, what's your aspiration, and explain your desire, first of all, to yourself. In this great reckoning that may expand gender possibilities for all, expand workplace opportunities for all, expand interpersonal relationships for all, first there will be the private reckoning, which some are doing. And I want to tell a funny story. There's a great clip from Seth Meyers of one of my favorite of his writers, Amber Ruffin, coming on stage, and she said, I'm gonna teach you guys how to apologize, and she hits Seth. It's staged. And she says, and Seth says, ow, you hit me, and she says, that was so long ago, I can't remember. And he says, but you hit me. And she says, I'm a different person now. And you hit me. And she says, well, I'm sorry if you were hurt. So that's the internal reckoning. How to really acknowledge that we have transgressed. Probably all of us. I'm not pointing the blame at women for being victims, but we've all forgotten to do things. We all didn't report things to HR when we saw something in our workplace. We all were reticent to call a spade, and to trust the victim. This happens all the time. Not just in sexual harassment litigation, but everywhere. Every kind of claim that ethics and morality should place on us. The failure is not just being the predator. Sometimes the failure is being a witness who doesn't say anything. Our sages knew that too. They talk about that, I think, in places like Sanhedrin, Talmud, where they acknowledge that not bearing witness is its own kind of crime. So where are we? What has this wrought on our society? Our ancestors ask, if you didn't notice, you didn't have the context, because we just started with the story of Judah and Tamar, that great story. But it's in the middle of Joseph's story. It's in the middle of Joseph being having his dreams and being sold down to Egypt. And it's interrupted. And our sages ask, there's a concept called smichut parshiot, the juxtaposition of different sections of Torah, which they understand to be there to teach us lessons. So the lesson they draw from this is this. This teaches that the brothers took him down, Judah, from his lofty position when they saw their father's pain. That Judah, who would, as I mentioned, become the progenitor of the nation, who would become the progenitor of the kingdom, was acknowledged in many ways to be the finest of the brothers. Certainly in the praises that we hear at the end of Genesis, Judah gets the best. And the brothers say to him, you told us to sell him. If you told us to return him, we would have listened to you as well. You could have done better, Judah. You are demeaned and diminished in our eyes. Because although you didn't consent that we murder him, you didn't do all that you could. You were lax. You were, light in your moral duty. You forsake anyone? How do you conjugate forsook? We'll discuss later at Kiddush. You forsaked, moving on. You abandoned your brotherly duty, your moral call. We'll discuss. I don't want to get too far afield. This is not a grammar course. Not just for Judah, but for all of us in any position of power, as parents, as coworkers, as supervisors, as people, other people in a restaurant who watch a date going awry, as taxi drivers who drive a couple home where they know it won't end well. We're all required to stand up. So I've mentioned before, this is one of my favorite people in the whole Torah. This is the first time we call anyone a friend. Judah is the first person in the Torah to have a friend. He has this fellow, Chira, who's an Adulamite, just like a local resident tribe, who's called his friend, first friend in the Torah. It's very sweet. So what Rashi tells us is that Judah, not just friends, but they were business partners, which suggests that Chira, like Judah, is in a position of power. Successful merchant, wealthy person, engaged in commerce, not in the lower echelons of society. Someone with hierarchical power. So we had a meeting with Justice Knox, a local community mobilization organization, to discuss the possibility that they might co-locate with us. So I don't want to give it away, we're still discussing that with the board, but one of the pieces of their mission is to gather people together to speak truth to power. Because you or I, relative to a county commissioner, relative to a mayor, relative to a governor, there's a clear hierarchy. Even though we can vote, our vote is very small. But if we gather 1,500 people together, we make a voting block that has authority, that can confront hierarchies. That's one of the issues, is to stand up both together, individually, internally, to do that internal work, to gather together, to recognize our debt to society, to reform and make a more just and equitable society. But we're all complicit. There was a Saturday Night Live sketch about the perfume Ivanka wears being called complicit. But we're all complicit in the failings of our society. We can't do everything. We can't stand up for every problem. We wouldn't have enough time. But we can't stand up for no problems. So Hira, when Judah's scepter, when Judah's emblem is to be returned for him from Tamar to demonstrate his complicity, his problem in non-marriage of Tamar, it's a little complicated to say, says we would be a laughingstock if this goes through. We. Judah was the one who failed his duty. But turning to Hira, they say we would be a laughingstock. Which is to tell us, they use the plural language, even though Hira isn't guilty, because he is also guilty. You're evaluated by your friends, say our sages. You rise and fall with them. As John Rawls would note, the success of a society really rests upon the success of the least of them. That's how we'll be evaluated. We'll be evaluated as individuals. Did we serve our highest common good? Were we predators? Were we cruel? Did we abuse our power? Did we reflect on our misdeeds and make atonement? But we'll also be evaluated for our part in other people's problems, in the things we failed to do in acts of omission. And my hope is that perhaps for the generation before us, that Mad Men era, I did not live through it, but I'm told Mad Men conveys a lot accurately. Everyone was sort of complicit in the alcoholism and harassment and racism of those offices. And in my generation, there is the reckoning, and my hope is that for my sons and our daughters and those who come after us, that it won't even get to that point, that the witness will stop the crime before it happens.